Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Associate Chair of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Back again to answer your questions, and if you have one, give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison. The number is 263-1890, and you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back.
Good morning, Larry and listeners. It's good to be here again. The months seem to pass very quickly.
Boy, you know, here we are to the first, the free fishing weekend in Wisconsin.
Yes, that's always a big weekend. People get a chance to test the waters, and the DNR fishing report is out, and you pick that up at the service centers. It was an insert into the recent issue of the DNR magazine, and looks like it's going to be another great year. Lots of fish.
Lots of fish out there. Bluegills are about ready to start bedding, and that will be good for the fishermen. That will be very good. Well, this is also a time of year. I don't know how many yearling deer I've seen along the roadside in the last week or two, but it's been a considerable number. And
well, typically June 1st is always considered the peak of fawn drop. I saw a newly dropped fawn last week up at the cabin in Price County, and they're around statewide and lots of them. And have been for a while, and will continue for the next few weeks. And of course, that begs the question of what should your response be if you stumble across a fawn that looks abandoned, lost, orphaned, or what have you?
Leave him alone.
The odds are in favor of the fawn that the doe is out there somewhere and does not spend all her time right at the side of the fawn, and will be back to take care of it. And if you intervene in that system, it's probably in the long run detrimental to the fawn. Now, having said that, there are certainly some cases where human intervention, in the case of if it's safe to, getting a turtle across the road or getting some ducklings over a curb or out of a storm sewer that they've fallen into, where intervention is a good thing, and we're glad people care. But for the most part, baby animals are able to take care of themselves. And, you know, the harsh sounding side of it is that these things are produced in incredible numbers. And if they all do survive, we end up with increasing problems with things like urban geese and the deer population and assorted other things. So anyway, for the most part, leave them alone.
I'll tell you what, the Orioles have not been leaving my grape jelly alone.
The Orioles in my yard have learned that they sit in the tree if I'm working in the garden and just kind of squawk a bit, and I can no more than turn my back and leave the garden, and the grape jelly is right on the arbor at the entrance to the garden, and they're there in a heartbeat. So we're going through a 2-pound jar of jelly about every 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
They just never leave there. It's a pretty good deal for them.
But it's a lot of fun to watch them come and go. I don't go through quite that much, but closing in on that. Sandy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My partner and I were out paddling the Ahara River on Sunday and saw what we thought might have been a weasel. We checked our track book, and it doesn't have a whole lot of information except about tracks and poop and stuff. And so we... But our best guess was that it was a weasel, perhaps a least weasel. It was pretty small, black, short tail.
Was it in the water?
And a little white fur under its neck, its chin.
Well, when you say small, when you say dark color like that and the white blaze under the neck, especially along a river system like that, I'm thinking mink.
Yeah.
And, they are a member of the weasel family, as are the true weasels and things on up to skunks and wolverines and whatnot. But in that setting, with the white blaze on the throat, the dark color, the short tail, the weasel-like form, a young mink is probably a better bet.
And is that likely in Madison?
Oh, sure. There's lots of them living along the Lake Mendota shoreline right here on campus.
Ah, so this was Tenney Park.
Yep, yeah. That's not at all unlikely.
He was cute, very active, fast, hopping up with the rocks and ducking down a little hole.
Sounds like mink to me.
Great.
All right, Sandy.
Okay.
Thanks
a lot for calling. Mink, you bet. Frank in Madison, hello to you.
Yes, simple question, maybe difficult answer. Where did all the grackles go? Not that I mind, but years ago, we had grackles all over the place. They were a real nuisance. And now, like this year, maybe even last year, I don't hardly see any of them.
Well, Frank, that is an interesting question, and it is a short question, but the answer may be a little more complicated. But now that you bring it up, often these things don't register until someone happens to mention it. And typically in the spring, I get a pretty regular string of calls from people who are complaining about grackles nesting in some big evergreens in the yard and dive bombing their cars or patios with the fecal sacs from the young.
That was a terrible problem.
That was a problem, and just the mobbing bird feeders and whatnot. I have not had one call this spring. Now, whether that I assume supports your argument that maybe the population's down. I did have a colleague mention yesterday that she's kind of quit feeding birds in her yard because all they seemed to get were grackles and cowbirds. Uh-huh. So there are some around in some places. But you're right. I haven't seen the masses of them coming through that I normally do. And, you know, it's possible that if that group of birds, kind of like crows, has been differentially affected by West Nile or some other problems, maybe the population is down.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling, Frank. And Phil in Evansville, it's your turn. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I just had a quick question for Scott. There's a really, really common raptor that I see flying around southern Dane County, northern Rock County all the time. They often hunt in pairs or more in groups. And, you know, they seem like a very large, dark bird with almost entirely dark.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you probably know what they are.
Well, the larger raptors that are normally circling over just about every woodlot and are almost constantly over my prairie are usually red tails. And, you know, depending on the lighting and backlighting and so forth, they will look very dark. Up close or perched in a tree, they'll usually show kind of a whitish belly or and striped breast and whatnot.
Yeah, but I know a red tail, but these are entirely dark. And I think they're a lot larger than your typical red tail.
Well, there aren't if they're entirely dark and they're soaring around and there are a couple of them, look to see if the wings are, rather than kind of level or horizontal, are cupped into a bit of a V. In other words, the wings are raised. The dark bird that's commonly soaring around this time of year is going to be a vulture.
Vulture.
I thought they might be. Yeah.
And that's they are a little bigger than red tails. They are dark. They do soar around like that. So I'm thinking if they're bigger than a red tail, you're seeing vultures, turkey vultures.
That would be my guess, too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Suzanne in Mineral Point, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi there. I just have a quick question for Scott. Thanks for taking my call. We have a tremendous coyote problem out in our area, and the coyotes come right up to the house during the day. You see them trying to lure the dogs out. They bother our herds of horses and cattle all night long.
Mm-hmm.
And we know we have tremendous numbers. Is anybody researching the numbers of coyotes, and is there anything we can do?
Well, the short answer is I don't know of any current research projects on coyote numbers or population trends. Coyotes have always been fairly abundant and often kind of flying under the radar screen if they stay discreetly out of sight. But yours apparently are no longer staying discreetly out of sight.
Oh, no.
If they've become emboldened to the point that you feel threatened or just don't want them that up close and personal, then they're a very very adaptable animal, and they've adapted well to pressure from hunting, trapping, control operations, and so forth. But those kinds of operations certainly put some wariness back in them. So when fall rolls around and trapping season, hunting season, and so forth, if you can enlist the aid of a local sportsman's club or some neighbors or something who might be interested in doing a little hunting or trapping, I think that kind of pressure on them will cause them to become a little less conspicuous.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, anything you can do to make them feel unwelcome, certainly make sure there's nothing around by way of pet food or anything else that they might find to be an attractive food source, and do what you can to discourage or frighten them when you see them. I'm not suggesting you necessarily have to kill them or attempt to injure them, but if a coyote were lurking around the back door and you fired a shotgun out the back door over their head, they're going to go in the opposite direction in a hurry and get the idea that that's not a good place to be. So I think there are ways to put a little fear back into them without necessarily hurting or injuring or killing them if that's not what you want to do. If you don't mind seeing the population reduced, then as I say, talk to your local DNR wildlife manager or a local sports person's club and see if you can get a little help with someone who's interested in hunting or trapping them.
And another thing you might be able to do as well is there are some guard dogs, like the Great Pyrenees is a good example of a dog that will take pretty good care of livestock and guard, essentially guard the place. And coyotes, I know Patricia McConnell's Great Pyrenees kept the coyotes completely off
bay,
bay off her farm. They just didn't go there.
Well, in our situation, we are surrounded by DNR land, and so we're talking hundreds of coyotes is what we're surrounded by. And so, you know, we've certainly shot the shotgun out the, you know, into the pair, and we've done things like that. We have two dogs. They're just, you know, the numbers are just increasing at such rapid rates that I just didn't know if it was something that anybody was studying.
Well, it's not, and that sounds like an unusual concentration for some reason. I think although the appearance may be hundreds, it's probably something less than that. They're pretty mobile, and they're pretty or they can be pretty conspicuous. But again, since there is public land around, whatever you can do on your property or encouraging on the surrounding land to get the word out to folks, hey, there's a high coyote density here. If you're interested in learning how to call them or hunt them or whatever, then that's a good place to do it.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, as we talk the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And let's take a call from Tim and Krivitz next. Hi, Tim.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
Morning.
My question is on black bears. Do they hunt fawns, and if they do, how often do they go after them? And also, what is a black bear's roaming radius?
Well, first of all, they are an important predator on fawns. They will take fawns. In fact, I was listening to someone relate a story whose turkey hunt, in his opinion, was ruined this spring because as he was sitting there calling turkeys, all of a sudden he heard this horrendous screaming and wailing and whatnot. And a matter of 50 yards away, a bear had grabbed a fawn, and the fawn was, well, ultimately failed in its resistance, but at least put up a little bit of unpleasant to hear wailing as the bear ultimately killed and ate it. So they do that, and bears have taken some of the elk calves as well at the elk restoration site up in northwestern Wisconsin. So yes, they do that, but the while it sounds harsh, I mean, the bears need to eat too, and the strategy the deer utilize is very effective, whether it's against coyotes, fox, bears, or any of the many other things that will eat fawns. They simply drop so many fawns in such a short window here in Wisconsin that the predators are overwhelmed. You know, how many fawns can a bear eat before it's, boy, enough's enough, I'm going to take a break here, and by then the fawns are old enough and quick enough that they can avoid bear predation. So it's only a very short window where the fawns are vulnerable to bears. And in terms of how far they wander, you know, certainly hundreds of acres, but it depends a little bit on what you mean by that. Bears that are displaced, problem bears, for example, that are moved 20, 30, 40 miles, may readily return to the site of the initial problem, leading to the three strikes and you're out policy. If the bears return a third time to a problem site, then they're usually euthanized. So they can cover a lot of ground.
If another bear comes into an area, will one try to boot out the other one?
Well, it depends a little bit on the age and sex of the bears involved. The boars aren't very tolerant of each other, but there certainly can be a lot of different bears using the same general area.
Yeah. Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. And we did have a little story about a bear that killed an alpaca in Marathon County a couple days ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Was that? It was, the dateline is June 4th. It was a bear that killed last week in Marathon County. And the alpaca was apparently very valuable, and the bear climbed a fence, entering an enclosed area, and dragged the alpaca away.
Oh, man.
Fawn's one thing, but if it's your multi-thousand-dollar alpaca, that causes a bit more anxiety.
Yeah. Jill in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a question about snakes. And I work somewhere where we have a fenced-in area that backs up to a wildlife preserve marsh area. And about this time of year, for the past couple of years, we've just been swarmed with snakes. Mm-hmm. Small, I mean, they're not huge. They're maybe about as thick as my finger and maybe about a foot, maybe a foot and a half long. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that we bring our dogs to work, put them in this fenced-in area, and the snakes aren't poisonous, but the dogs like to play with them. So for the snake's sake, and also for the sake of the employees, because half of us are absolutely terrified of these things, and mm-hmm. one winds up getting inside at least once a year, is there anything we can do to convince them that they don't want to be a tug toy?
Well, if how big is the fenced area?
It's maybe about a half acre.
Well, it's a pretty good size. All right.
Yeah.
And there's a variety of cover types within the fenced area. There's some bushes, there's trees, there's grass, and so forth?
No, the fenced-in area is just, it's all mowed grass.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, when you say lots of snakes, I mean, if you went out there, would you see dozens of snakes or just the occasional snake?
Probably on a nice, warm morning, we could see anywhere from 6 to 10.
Okay. Well, the possibility exists that either somewhere within that enclosed area or nearby, there's a hibernaculum, a site that those snakes, and they're probably garter snakes, mm-hmm. A site that they're using to spend the winter, where snakes from a considerable area concentrate, sometimes in incredible numbers, spend the winter there, and then disperse in the spring back out into the marshes and fields and so forth, where they assume a normal density of, you know, snake here, snake there, but not yeah. 8 or 10 snakes sitting out in the open grass. Mm-hmm. So if if you or the grounds managers or whatever can look around a little bit and just see if there's anything inside the fence or close by outside the fence, even maybe relating to the building, where there might be an old rock pile, a crack in the foundation, an old well or cistern, some site that might be attractive to those snakes as a hibernaculum, then that might either be modified or fenced off from your fenced area such that the snakes could go about their business and not necessarily cause you a problem. They've got to be coming in. They can easily penetrate the fence. It's also possible, if you want to go to the expense, if they seem to always come from one side or one direction, a fairly low sheet metal barrier could be installed at the base of the fence, or for that matter, even some quarter-inch hardware cloth, galvanized hardware cloth, sunk down into the sod a couple inches and then maybe, you know, 10 inches to a foot above the fence, so that essentially there's a snake-proof barrier there that would diminish their free movement back and forth across the fence.
The other way to deal with it.
And there is only one commercial repellent that I know of. It's called Dr. T's Snake Away, just the capital letter T, and it's a mixture of ground sulfur and naphthalene flakes, and you can sprinkle this along a fence barrier or foundation barrier. And the label is very specific about the types of snakes it will repel, but it presumably sets up a barrier that the snakes are reluctant to cross. So that's another possibility.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Joyce in Genoa City is up next. Hi, Joyce.
Hello. I was wondering if you could tell me how to keep a skunk from roaming around right outside my house. We live on about an acre and a half in town, and we have about a third of it is wooded, and there's also a lot of bushes and things up near the house.
Sounds like a great place for a skunk.
It is.
You know, there's not a great deal you can do, you know, short of really exorbitant techniques like fencing or other things that would keep out a variety of animals. But if you have a nice, diverse wildlife habitat like that in an otherwise semi-urban setting, I'm guessing you have a lot of different animals visiting the property, and that's probably something you want.
Yes.
So the fact that there's a skunk there occasionally is in a way the cost of doing business. And as long as he's not, you know, spraying and you can go your separate paths, he's probably not a huge problem either, unless they start digging in the turf for grubs and things like that.
Well, actually, he is spraying, and he is digging in the turf.
Okay,
yeah.
So then maybe it's time to remove the skunk. And if that's the case, they are very easy to live trap. The problems really start for most people once you've actually caught the skunk in the live trap, because then it's, oh my gosh, how do I actually deal with this thing? And if you either use a solid trap, a wooden trap, or a trap that's got a heavy material on it so that it's there's no light passing through, once the skunk is in that dark space, they're really quite docile. And, you know, 95 times out of 100, at that point, the trap can be picked up and moved with the live skunk inside, as long as it's in the dark, with little risk of being sprayed. Of course, it's those 5 times out of 100 that make people very nervous. But I've seen the folks who know what they're doing walk up to a trap, walk up to an open live trap with a skunk in it, carrying a tarp or an old blanket or even a big black plastic trash bag, and just slowly and deliberately, with no noise and commotion, quietly cover the trap. The skunk is entirely docile, and then they remove it either to a site where, in most cases, they're going to be euthanized, because in Wisconsin, because of the disease transmission risk, it's not advisable to relocate skunks the way you might relocate other animals. They probably should be put down. If that's not something you want to, it's not difficult to do, but if it's not something you want to tackle yourself,
I probably couldn't.
Then there are many. There are people around, often people associated with the Wisconsin Trappers Association or some of the pest control companies, or people who are freelancing as wildlife control specialists, who would come and set the trap and remove the skunk. And then the extent of your contribution to the whole effort is to sign a check over to them for the service.
Okay.
And that might be the best way to... Realizing, of course, that there may be more than one skunk, and if you remove a skunk, there may be another one to take its place. But if this one's particularly problematic, then maybe it's time for the skunk to go.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can find those people in the yellow pages of the phone book, too.
Yeah, or call a DNR service center and see if they can connect you with somebody in the WTA, the Trappers Association, and usually get some help that way.
Judy in Kiel is up next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Speaking of trapping, we had a mink in our backyard in the city of Sheboygan when we lived there, and our chihuahua attacked it and had it by its neck and was whipping it around, and we ended up having to call a wildlife guy, and he trapped it and took it away. But I was just shocked that right there in Sheboygan we had a mink.
I'm not shocked by the mink in Sheboygan, but I'm pretty shocked by the chihuahua whipping a mink around.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he is. He is something else, and that's what I'm actually calling about. We recently moved out into the country. He is just a little warrior. He's a chihuahua Pomeranian mix of 6 pounds, and he. We're living in a place now along the Sheboygan River out in the woods. The whole house is surrounded by woods with some a lot of open spaces, lawn area.
Mm-hmm.
And we are concerned about hawks hunting him. He's a tan, his color is tan, and somebody said, oh, you better watch out because, you know, he could just pick him up and take him away. So what we have been doing is we have a little jacket we put on him that has little like shiny diamond studs on it, hoping that it'll discourage the hawk from, you know, picking him up and taking him away, because we let the dogs run loose. They stick close to the house. But any suggestions?
Well, first of all, he seems like a feisty little guy, and I'm suspecting he can take care of himself in a situation like that. A 6-pound dog, for most of our resident hawks, I mean, short of a passing eagle, would be more than a handful.
Okay, good.
Although, even with the studded jacket on, you know, they do make mistakes. I remember hunting with a friend who had a trained red tail at falconry, and the hawk came down and to grab something in a wetland. And as we watched, the next thing we knew, what the hawk had seen was this wiggling brown thing. And all of a sudden, it dove into the marsh grass, and up jumped a deer with the hawk hanging onto its ear. So they occasionally make mistakes, and
it
quickly realized the error in its ways and let go. But barring some incredible mistake, I think your dog is pretty safe.
Good. That's very good to hear. It puts our hearts at ease because we'd hate to lose them.
All right. Thanks, Trudy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call. Oh, that's a good story.
It was really fun to see that thing dangling. The deer's ear was hanging down with the hawk hanging. I said, what have I done here? But
well, the poor deer just laying there asleep or something.
Something's got me by the ear.
Ruth and Appleton, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning. I have a question about crows.
Okay.
Our garden is just starting to come up, and there is a flock of crows that I'm afraid nothing is going to survive. As my beans come up, I know they're going to pull them all out, and they'll probably pull all my onions out, too. We put an owl up, but I'm thinking owls aren't out in the daytime, and crows are not really dumb. So.
Well, worse yet, owl decoys are used to hunt crows because the crows will mob the owl decoy, so the owl decoy may actually attract them.
Oh,
you know, the old folk tale, if you want to protect a garden from a crow, what you need is a dead crow. That I've had people swear by that particular tactic, and in the absence of a true dead crow, which you might find along the side of the road or whatnot, there may be crow decoys that could be hung upside down that might provide you with some relief. But how big's your garden?
Oh, 15 by 50, maybe.
Okay, so it's not that big. If things really got bad, my suggestion would be a piece of plastic bird netting, which you can get in huge sheets, even that size.
Okay.
But a piece that you could, even 10 feet square, that you could move from vulnerable row to vulnerable row, I think would allow you to protect whatever you have.
Okay.
Okay?
And then I also have a question on earwigs.
Well, I can't probably say too much about that, but go ahead.
They eat off the chrysanthemums, they eat off the marigolds and the daisies, and I'm wondering what is safe to put on there.
That I can't help you with. I would recommend you call or email Phil Pelletieri, who's a regular guest on the program, or go to your local garden center and ask what insecticide do you recommend for earwig control. They're tough little buggers and obnoxious things, but
and I'm thinking maybe there's something, you know, not an insecticide. Maybe there's something a little more earth friendly.
Well,
Phil will have the answer if it is. I'm trying to recall because someone else asked that question, and I don't know that there's a lot of hope. But Phil will have the answer, so give him a call at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. And actually, you can go online probably. Go online to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be on June 18th, by the way, if you can wait that long. If not, the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab, you can go to that website and his and phone number and address and all that. You can just email him. Yeah. So we'll go from there, Ruth, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Joyce in Menominee Falls. Scott's got the number for the – what's the number for Phil?
I think Phil? It's 262-6510.
262-6510.
Area code 608. But anyway.
Joyce in Menominee Falls. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about wild turkeys.
Okay.
Number one, do they only come out in the rain? Because I just spent the last hour observing two. And it seems like every time we observe them in our yard here, it's raining.
I think that's accidental. The turkeys are there, whether it's rain or shine. And the one thing going for them, sometimes on a rainy day, especially when the vegetation is soaked in the woods and the leaves are wet and everything else, the turkeys like to get out in the open where they can dry off a little bit. So that might be part of it, but there's no relationship, I don't believe, other than accidentally here, that you're only seeing them on rainy days.
Mm-hmm. And if I saw the two of them, we know that one female went into the woods, like in maybe March, was it? And now there's this second one who is slightly smaller. Do poults achieve almost adult size in that short of a time?
No, it's too early for the poults to be mistaken for an adult.
Okay, so then this would be another female.
Not necessarily. It could be a jake, which is a young male. There's a whole, within the turkey population, you have everything from huge old gobblers with ground-dragging beards to jakes and down to poults of various sizes as the broods mature. So you're probably seeing, if there's no beard, either a short stubby one or a long one, then you are seeing a hen, but whether it's a yearling or a well-advanced poult or a mature hen, depends entirely on the size and season.
Yeah, I don't see any beard in the both of the birds have whitish or light blue heads.
Yeah, they're kind of dull colored. So those are probably both hens. One may be older than the other one.
Uh-huh. And so they would be forming a flock maybe?
Not necessarily. I mean, this time of year you'd expect most breeding hens to be on a nest or with poults, but they leave the nest to feed occasionally, and it could be a bird that doesn't have a nest or their nest was destroyed. Predators often get the nests, and all of a sudden the hens are back on the move again looking to remate.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All
right. Thank you so
much. Thank you very much for calling, Joyce. And let's go to John in Eau Claire next. Hi, John.
Good morning. This is a question about orioles.
Okay.
We live in the country, and for the last several years, we've been able to attract a lot of orioles with grape jelly.
Mm-hmm.
They've nested and seem to have stayed around all summer. This spring, we had several come in. They've been just devouring our grape jelly.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, the last ones we saw were last Friday. We haven't seen an oriole since last Friday, and I'm wondering if you have some idea what might be going on.
Well, I mean, a couple of things possibly. In the one hand, as these birds move through, you may attract some pairs that are not necessarily destined to nest in your immediate area, but hang around for a while, take advantage of the jelly, and then off they go.
Uh-huh.
The birds that I have now that are really working over the jelly, usually until about now or maybe another few weeks, will be regular visitors. And then apparently when the young hatch, there seems to be a period where they stop coming to the jelly. And
be a hatch going on now?
Yes.
Yeah, it could be.
It's about that time. But there usually seems to be a period. I know the birds are still around and they likely have young, but they just kind of give up on the jelly.
Okay.
And the hummingbirds... Now, too, if they've been coming to your hummingbird feeders, if you have them, they will quit, too, about, if I'm not mistaken.
That was
about...
part two of the question.
Oh, well, they'll quit.
They aren't seeing the hummingbirds.
Well, that's because they're on their nests. They're on their nests.
Yeah, and the bird activity comes and goes with migration, with nesting activity, with brood-rearing activities. So there are spikes and troughs in bird activity throughout the time they're here.
Yep.
Okay.
But the good news is it's usually something related to their normal breeding cycle or annual behavior rather than some environmental calamity that, all the hummingbirds or orioles just died.
Yeah.
That's not usually the case.
All right. Thanks, John.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Chris in Waterloo, hello to you.
Hello. My name is Chris, and I live out in the country between Waterloo and Lake Mills. And my question concerns a type of scat on my property.
Okay.
Scat, that's our specialty.
Oh, good. there's two areas that are maybe like a 8x8, and they're kind of an indentation on my property. I have 6 acres, and it's very near the road, but kind of hidden by trees. And we found large amounts of huge scat. Like something has been coming back and repeatedly depositing this. And it's a kind of a grayish brown color. Any thoughts?
Well, what I mean, scat comes in all shapes and forms.
You know,
deer and rabbit scat is in the form of pellets.
Yeah.
Very distinct pellets.
Not pellets.
So it's more dog-like, a long...
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, And when you say large, an individual piece, are you talking the size of your finger or the size of your arm? Or
probably resembling human feces. And the piles, like at one sitting, it could be 2 to 3 feet. It's a lot.
Whoa.
What? Two to 3 feet?
Mm-hmm.
The pile diameter?
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's huge. And then there are other little piles that are less.
And no domestic stock around.
No.
Man, I'd get a camera.
Well, yeah, that's probably a good idea. That's a good idea. The camera is a good idea for two reasons. Number one, that's a perfect place to set up one of these remotely triggered cameras,
yeah,
a trail
mm-hmm.
camera, and see what you get pictures of.
Right.
That will give you an immediate answer.
Mm-hmm.
The other use of the camera is to just go out with your digital camera, take a picture, and then
mm-hmm.
email it in and either to us or the DNR office or something and get some idea when we can actually see it.
Mm-hmm.
The third alternative is to either online or at a bookstore or nature center. Look at something like Mark Elbrock's Mammal Tracks and Sign,
mm-hmm.
and all the scat for all the different local species are all nicely organized in there with color photographs, and you can see what looks like what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
When you said it's all in one place, the wild...
In this like 8x8 area.
Right. I mean, one wild animal that often it defecates in the same area repeatedly are raccoons, but
yeah,
you
no.
wouldn't expect a pile that size.
I mean,
yeah.
That's
you know, when you start to
amazing.
Get to when you start to get to scat the size of you know, a pie or something, if you're ruling out domestic stock, I mean, you've got to be talking about a pretty big animal, you know, bear mm-hmm. size.
That's what I'm wondering.
And you know, well, I mean, there have been...
How about bobcats?
No, not...
No.
A bear is unlikely where you are, but more likely than a bobcat. And the scat would not be that large.
Uh-huh.
So I think we need a little more information here, or you need to do a little detective work. But,
uh-huh.
you know, find somebody in the neighborhood out in the countryside. I'm sure there's a neighbor with a trail camera and
right.
say, hey, I got something really neat going on over here. Could you
uh-huh.
put your camera out here for a couple nights? And you'll
okay.
quickly figure out what's going on.
Okay.
Okay.
And I do have a dog, and I took my dog after we found this because it's kind of hidden. I took her near it to see if she would do anything, and she didn't at all.
No.
It was like it wasn't there. I thought, you know, maybe an odor would scare her.
But you're sure it's scat?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there are other...
I'm a nurse. So.
Okay, I'm just thinking when you set a low spot, you know, there are other things that create a gray pile of stuff that might look like a scat. For example, have you ever seen a crayfish mound?
No.
I mean, where crayfish, which will live in a low spot,
mm-hmm.
Will push up these pellets of mud, essentially, that dry out into this gray, it kind of looks more like if you've seen a swallow nest plastered on a barn.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing lying in piles on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And those could be quite sizable. So you might entertain the idea that it is something else other than scat. But again, a camera will help ascertain that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information.
Okay.
Yep, thanks, Chris, for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lots of great questions coming in here on the Ideas Network about our Wisconsin wildlife. What about you? If you have a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Vic in Eagle River is up next. Hi, Vic.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
See, first of all, a quick one. The lady who's having problems with the crows, if she has any trees or anything around, and she can string out some monofilament horizontally. It does a great job and can give you some entertainment, too, while you're watching the crows hit it.
Yeah.
Even
from garden fence posts, if they're high enough, it'll
yeah,
help.
Right. It doesn't have to be high. Just get it in there randomly. They don't see it, it works great. I use it myself. The reason I called is we're out east of Eagle River here, and we have a sow running around with four cubs.
Mm-hmm.
This one of them is kind of a runt, but they're still all with her. And that,
mm-hmm.
That's the first time we've seen that many here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering how common that is.
Not very. It's obviously on the high end of the distribution, but you know, much like deer and other animals, the litter size varies, and there's a norm, and then there are extremes. So it's about as unlikely as a doe with three fawns. And even quadruplets occur with deer, too. But
mm-hmm.
it's unusual, but it happens.
Okay.
All right.
Well, it was interesting. She is a little bit larger than
than your average bear.
Yeah. Also, so I figure that may have something to do with it. But she's still dragging them all along with her. And
fun to watch.
Well, sounds like they'll do okay, even the runt.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot, Vic, for calling. Tom and Mequon, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hope you give me a minute. I have a couple questions. My first is about, I have a hawk that's taking small birds from my feeders, and it's a medium-sized bird. And I've only seen it from the back as it flew right by me and took a bird like 10 feet from me.
It's okay. We don't need much of a description. It's a Cooper's hawk.
Yeah.
A Cooper's hawk, you
mm-hmm.
think?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Bold. Very bold.
Very bold.
I was sitting looking at this feeder, and it flew right by me, and I saw it as it opened up its wings and it grabbed this little chickadee and then took off in the woods. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Another question I have is about hummingbirds. I'm wondering, I can't buy the syrup mix I used to buy for the food, and all I can get is like this powder, which they don't seem to like. And I'm wondering if you would have a
if it's more convenient. Obviously, everybody makes a living, and some make a living selling hummingbird nectar mix. But I've never used anything but a cup of sugar and 4 cups of water.
Mine holds a quarter cup of sugar and a cup of water, and replace that.
You just have to heat that up and let it make a syrup, and then cool it down and put it in your feeder. But a homemade sugar water syrup is all you need.
So would you put like a red food coloring in it then?
No, the red is irrelevant. If you've got a feeder that's the red is simply a reasonable attractant to the birds, and that's why most of the plastic feeders have a red flower or a red base or something. But there's no need at all to color the solution.
So you're saying about a quarter cup of sugar and then
4 to 1. 4 to 1 water. You can make a 50-gallon barrel if you want, as long as you make the 4 to 1 ratio of water to sugar.
And then you boil it then for like 10 minutes or something.
Oh no, just to heat it up and just to heat it up and get it all completely dissolved, and then cool it down and fill your feeder.
And then you keep it in the fridge then, I would imagine, huh?
Generally I figured out what my feeder capacity was and then just made whatever I needed to fill the feeder. There's no real reason to store it. It's that it takes, 2 minutes to make this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
I use the quarter cup sugar and a cup of water because that fills the feeder about 3/4 full. And you like to change that, either get it used or changed fairly regularly.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't get moldy and whatnot.
Yeah.
Lastly, I was wondering, where can I find some information so I can tape these birds like with a tape recorder? Who would have like microphones or ways to tape these birds at some distance away? You know, like 50 feet.
Well,
there are
all sorts of fancy parabolic receivers and whatnot that you can use to create or tape record bird songs. I would start out with a bird specialty store like a Wild Birds Unlimited store or Chickadee Depot or something like that. They're likely to have it right there, but if not there, then online. You should be able to find whatever you want.
Mm, I see. Okay, because I'm just getting interested in this now, and it's pretty interesting, I'll tell you.
It's tricky recording, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of other sounds that when you're listening outside, listen for street traffic or air traffic or other kinds of sounds sometimes ruin what you think is going to be a pretty good recording.
It's pretty quiet where I live, so I don't really have to worry about that too much.
Good. Well, go at it.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Becky in Winneconne, it's your turn next. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I have a question. You may have already covered it because I missed the first part of the program. But we used to have just 2 pairs of grosbeaks that would come back every year. And we'd have, maybe 1 pair of Baltimore Orioles. And this year, I mean, it's just unbelievable. we've got like 6 pairs of grosbeaks, and we've got Orioles all over the place. We even have indigo buntings, which we've only seen twice in the 25 years we've lived here. And I'm just wondering if you know why we have so many more of these this year.
So you're talking about rose-breasted grosbeaks.
Well, and the Orioles and many of the other birds, too. They just seem to be a lot more of them this year.
Well, it's a good year, and sometimes you can't say much more than that. I've got probably two or three or four pair of grosbeaks coming in regularly to the feeder, and I've been lucky in the past to see a single pair. And there seem to be a lot of rose-breasted grosbeaks around. So if for some species it's a matter of where they really had a good reproductive year last year, things went well on the wintering grounds, there's lots of them coming back. Maybe the next year it's not so good, and the numbers decline again. An earlier caller was concerned that they hadn't seen any grackles to speak of, which they felt was a good thing. So all of these populations have a bit of a give and take to them, superimposed on the long-term trends of the population. So, you know, obviously for whatever reason, it's a good year for grosbeaks. Perhaps just in your area, but maybe overall as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, Becky. Roy in Hurley is up next. Hi, Roy.
Good morning, men. These people are troubled with skunks and woodchucks. I'll tell you what works real good is ammoniated rags. Even bears don't like them. So if they got a location where somebody's wandering around steady, just plant some of those things around, they'll disappear.
Yeah.
Ammonia and naphthalene are a couple of things that are very obnoxious to most mammals. You just have to be a little bit careful with some of them that there aren't problems with pets or kids or other things, too. But that's a common suggestion.
Common suggestion. Thanks, Roy.
Thanks, Roy.
Thanks for calling. And Laura is up next from Baraboo. Hi, Laura.
Hi. We have had a terrible time with the moles that have and they're right up to the house, and they're uprooting all of my flowers and ruining my perennials. And I just wondered, is there anything that will deter them to move on?
Well, they're driving me nuts in my garden right now, tunneling under rows and pushing seedlings out. But right now, conditions are just perfect for moles. The soil is quite moist, and it looks like it's going to stay that way with a rainy period coming up. But when things dry out toward midsummer, the moles will usually go deeper and you won't have to worry about them. In terms of dealing with them right now, you only have, if you can't wait until they change their behavior, the only two immediate things you can do is either employ a good mole trap, like the Victor harpoon trap. So if you've got the traps out and you move those around to active runways, you can really make a dent in the mole population. There's never as many of them as the amount of digging suggests. So if you catch a couple, you could really make some inroads. Number two, the still relatively new repellents, and there are a whole bunch of them now that are based on castor oil, like Mole Med and Shotgun and Science Mole Repellent. There are a bunch of different brand names. But one of the original ones was called Mole Med, MOLE-MED.
Okay.
They all work about the same way. You mix them and then apply them with a hose end sprinkler and water them into the lawn or the area around your house or whatever you're trying to protect. And that will give you, you know, most people claim in a month, 6 weeks, maybe 2 months of reasonably mole-free time before that application wears off.
Okay.
All right.
Great. I will try that. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Laura. And Cheryl's next in Oconomowoc. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a problem with some very aggressive swallows that are continually trying to make a nest in the boat cover. And
we
live on a lake, and I knock it down every day. It's not getting to the point where the nest is built, but I do knock it down every day. And they are very aggressive. They're attacking me every morning when I go down there.
So
I don't know what else to do other than knock it down, but they keep coming back, and then they have their droppings all over the boat. So do you have any other suggestions other than knocking down the nest?
Well, they're very persistent, and you have to be equally persistent if you're ultimately going to beat them. And eventually they'll get to the point where either the nesting season is getting too late or they just simply give up the ghost and move to another spot. However, the better long-term solution, and I having trouble envisioning how or where they are under your boat hoist, or so this is like a shore station and you've got a...
Yes.
Okay. Then I think... depending on how close your boat comes or the windshield comes to the arch of the boat hoist, if you can stretch and attach, and you can do it with Velcro, bird netting under the overhang of the boat hoist, then there's no way the swallows can get up in there. There's no place for them to nest.
Yeah.
So if you can tolerate the bird netting, because you get snagged on it, like if you're putting a fishing rod in a boat, it constantly snagged in that stuff. But if you can put it up for the period you need to deter the swallows, it'll completely eliminate the problem.
Mm-hmm. I felt like their nesting season was going on a little too long. I felt like I was battling longer than ever this year. But
They're incredibly persistent, and they do get obnoxiously aggressive, but you can continue to battle them day to day, or you can put up that barrier and be done with it.
Yeah,
I like that idea. Okay.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling.
We should point out, I mean, the bird netting will work, but if it's easier to use a solid plastic sheet like Visqueen or Vapor Barrier, that'll work too.
Yeah, that'll work very well. But I had the same issue with my shore station, and I just kept, you have to keep at it every day or get smart.
The problem is if you're gone for a weekend, that's all the time they need to get the nest established. And then if there's eggs or young in there, then theoretically you're not supposed to be messing with them anymore.
Well, I tell you what, we will be talking some more maybe about swallows. We will also maybe be talking about orioles here, but we've got Scott Craven with us right now to talk about all kinds of things. And if you want to join in with your questions and comments, feel free at 1-800-642-1234. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Pleased to have you listening in. Scott, there was a hairy feral pig that weighed almost 500 pounds, wasn't it? Found on highway?
Over near Viroqua, I guess. It was hit by a car. I'm trying to think of the
same morning of May 16th.
Yes, just a couple weeks ago. So, you know, the feral pig issue is an ongoing concern. In fact, just after this, I think perhaps precipitated by this particular incident, the folks over in the Kickapoo Valley at Lafarge have invited me over to do a talk later on this summer on feral pigs, and we'll be doing that at some point. We haven't set the date yet, but it's still a concern, especially in west central Wisconsin, where there are still some of those animals out there. But, boy, it'd be nice to see them eliminated from the landscape. They're incredibly destructive.
You know, we talk about the price of everything going up in gas and everything else, but I tell you what, as you look at sunflower seeds and corn and for feeding birds.
Tell me about it. I tried to get out and get some sunflower seeds last night. I saw one place had 50-pound bag was, I think, $24. I think, wow, that must be an aberration. But I haven't found them any cheaper anywhere else. So, you know, it used to be a 50-pound. Of course, you know, I suppose candy bar used to be a nickel, too. But not that long ago, you thought $10, $11, $12 was a fair price for a 50-pound bag of sunflower seeds. But it's double that now. A bag of 50 pounds of shell corn, which, of course, there's another issue with corn. If people are using it to feed deer, that's another can of worms, so to speak. But that's gone at the co-op where I usually look at those kinds of things from $3-something a bag to $7-something a bag in a relatively short period of time. So I'm wondering if ultimately these increased feed prices may slow down some of the feeding we just as soon not see going on, like the deer feeding, but at the same time may hurt some of the folks who are hoping to feed the birds.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
We'll have to wait and see. Diane in Appleton has a question for you. Diane, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
Or afternoon.
Afternoon.
I was wondering if it's too late to attract Baltimore Orioles.
Probably not. I mean, they're around. It may take them a little while to find if a jelly feeder, if that's what you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
The orange halves that I use on either end of my feeder are very visually, I mean, they're obvious, and I think that's maybe what cues the orioles in to check it out in the first place. And then once the orange halves have gotten them there, which they'll also eat, then I pretty much hit them with the jelly, because jelly is a lot cheaper than a bag of oranges right now.
Right. And should that be out in the open, or should it be near trees, or where is the best place to locate these?
I hang mine from a tree.
You can hang it from a tree. I have mine hanging from an arbor that enters the garden. You could put a shepherd's crook up and hang it in the open. I think the orioles will find it, and if there's a fence or an arbor or a tree nearby that they can use as a perch or a launching site to get to the grape jelly, any of those sites will work fine.
And what about the grosbeaks? Is there anything, we had some earlier, to keep them around, or do they migrate, or what?
Well, they will use an area, and if it's suitable for nesting, they'll stay. But mm-hmm. they also, people see them as they're moving through, and then mm-hmm. if they stay, they'll be regular visitors at your feeder. But if you've got a feeding station, sunflower seeds are as good as anything as far as a foodstuff. And if they stay, they stay. And if they don't, you'll catch them again on the migration.
They don't. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call as well. Denise in Lamira, you are up. Hi, Denise.
Hi there. I have a question about a fisher.
Okay.
We have an outside dog, and he catches any and everything. And we believe he got a fisher about 2 weeks ago. Is that possible?
In Lamira?
Yep.
Well,
well, we learned pictures of it, and because you know, and it's big, it's brown, it has a long, fluffy tail. It has long back feet, you know, and it's not a raccoon or a possum. We know that for sure.
Well, the description certainly sounds right. I'm kind of a dark chestnut brown.
Yep, because we thought it was a very large cat at first.
Hmm. Well, you know, we learned a long time ago to never say never on the program, and certainly that's not a place where you'd expect a fisher, but there have been lots, I shouldn't say lots, plenty of examples of photographs of fishers turned in at places like, have a nice one from Governor Dodge State Park over near Dodgeville, and other places in the southern part of the state where they've been turning up. So it's a possibility. Do you still have the picture?
We have the pictures, but we took the pictures like 4 days later, so they're not the best. And well, I did send them to somebody, but she was pretty sure it was a raccoon. But I know what a raccoon looks like, and it's not a raccoon.
Well, I'm not sure who you send. I mean, there'd be little opportunity to confuse a fisher if you could see the tail,
right.
See the tail with a raccoon. But, you know, certainly raccoons do come in different color phases. I mean, the common coloration is common, but I've seen them almost black and almost blonde.
Yeah, no. It wasn't, like I said, he's brought home pretty much any critter around our house, from woodchucks to possums, raccoons, and
fisher,
never anything like this.
Fisher would be a real, would be a challenge for a dog. I mean,
I
would have expected it to put up a pretty good account of itself, but even if the picture's bad, is it digital or is it a snapshot?
It's a snapshot.
Well, I mean, if you'd be willing, if you still have one, and you'd be willing
sure.
to send one in either to the studio here to Larry or to my mm-hmm. office in
We'd
the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, we'll take a look and send it back to you.
All right, that'd be fine.
Okay.
Wildlife and Ecology?
Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology.
All righty.
Room 120 Russell Labs, UW-Madison, 53706.
Mm-hmm.
And just mark it to my attention, and we'll have a look.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, I'm kind of interested to know myself. Peg in, it's really, a fisher in Lamira would be unusual. Peg in Rice Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. I've been having a wonderful time with two bears this spring,
mm-hmm.
a mother and a cub. And they've been hanging around for about 2 weeks, and it's been just a party for me. I know so much about, I saw them do a bluff charge. Oh, it's great. But the problem I'm worried about is that there are always a few neighbors who go hysterical, and they talk, you know, kill, trap, etc. And we had a mother with three cubs a couple years ago here, and I heard she was trapped and relocated. What I'm wondering, I can't imagine how a mother bear is going to take care of her babies in a totally foreign territory, probably with other bears that don't want her there. I'm wondering if anyone has made any study of the survival rate of such cubs.
So the bear was moved with her cubs.
That's what they told me.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're pretty resourceful, and I would assume that the folks who are relocating them, whether with the DNR or USDA's Wildlife Services folks, I mean, know what they're doing and know what constitutes reasonable bear habitat. And I suspect if the bear is moved to reasonable bear habitat, it's got a pretty good chance of survival and taking care of its cubs. And the fact that so many of them actually, although it may take a while, return to the original location of capture suggests that they're able to move around the landscape until they find some place that they think is suitable, and they should be fine. So relocation of problem bears is a common thing to do. And as far as I don't think anybody's necessarily working on it right now, but my impression is that the survival of those relocated bears is quite good.
Just one other thing. Is there anyone anywhere who is trying to do education about living with bears? Because so many people today have moved out in the country like I am.
Mm-hmm.
I've been out here 22 years, so, I mean, I've had bears and bears, you know. But
There's some terrific literature available on living with bears. The Forest Service has a brochure called Living with Black Bears. And at a recent conference, I picked up a really nice series on all things bear and how to get along with them and live side by side with them. I just can't remember what the source was. But I'm guessing that anybody with anybody fluent with the internet could do a little Googling on something like living with black bears and come up with some really nice educational material. And any nature center around the state would be likely to be either able to offer some advice or a program or get somebody in to do a program on living with black bears.
That's what I'd like to see, is a live speaker and somebody to sit down with people and say, hey, kids, you got to be careful. But adults, you don't need to freak out immediately.
Well, there are lots of people who could do that. So if you've got a nature center nearby or a historical society or even a DNR office, you know, urge them to invite somebody in to talk about it.
Yeah, and good luck. Thank you, Peg, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Barb in Wisconsin Rapids is up next. Barb, hello.
Hi, Barb. Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
We have a robin nesting mystery here maybe you can solve. We had a robin build a big, beautiful nest right outside our front door in an outdoor light fixture, created quite a mess, and the front door was off limits, but that was okay. We gave her her space. And I had read in one of my bird books that the female incubates for 12 to 14 days. So we watched her for, well, a good 2 weeks, and she was faithfully on the nest. In fact, I wondered if she was even eating. She was just always there, and she changed position, you know, east, west, south. We thought she was probably giving all the eggs equal time. Once when she was off the nest and she never flew very far out of the yard, my husband tried to take a little ladder to peek in the nest and see, you know, what was going on. But because it was so positioned in this light fixture, he really couldn't see into the nest. I mean, it was really secure, very protected, and it appeared to be quite deep. She, you know, robin's a big bird, and when she was in the nest, all you could see was her head and her tail. I mean, she was really in the nest. So anyway, 2 weeks went by, and this past Sunday morning, we saw her, but then we didn't see her for the rest of the day, which was very, very unusual. She was just gone. So by evening, we were really wondering what was going on, and because we couldn't see in the nest, my husband took his camera, his digital camera, and just kind of positioned it over the nest and took a picture. And it was empty. I mean, there was absolutely nothing there. Could she have been, you know, just sitting on an empty nest for 2 weeks?
No, she was probably sitting on eggs, but something got the eggs in the intervening time, and then she abandoned the nest.
But wouldn't we have seen some, you know, some
would've
remains
happened,
of
would've
eggshells
happened
or
night,
something?
It could have happened at night, and it could have happened in an instant.
Yeah.
Where nothing would be left?
Sure, they might have just taken the eggs.
Grabbed the whole egg.
Grabbed the whole egg and gone.
Like what? Like what would get up there?
A variety of other birds, a squirrel, a rat.
Raccoon.
A whole host of things.
Up in a light fixture.
Sure.
Well, we thought for sure we'd see eggshells or something.
No, then in many cases the egg is just a robin's egg is not that big. Even a grackle or a blue jay could carry a robin's egg away completely, and that would be the end of it. So it's very unlikely the bird simply sat there on an empty nest as regularly and with the attentiveness that you described. So I think she did incubate, but the eggs just disappeared.
Just disappeared. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, well, I had really become attached to her. You know, being a mother, I was really, you know, had some empathy.
Happens all the time. And in the future, if that site is used or if the bird re-nests there, the trick that the folks who are working with birds' nests use to see what's going on is to just get a little round mirror and put it on the end of a pole, and then you can hold the mirror up over the nest and look right in it and see what's going on.
Would you suggest we... You know, could she come back to this nest? They brood two or three a year, don't they? Or should we take the nest down? What?
She might, but if the nest is messy or caused you to cause cease and desist on using the front door, I'd take it down. She'll find another spot. And there are many designs for building a nesting shelf for robins that you could mount on the side of the house a ways away from the front door and still provide something for the robin but not have to give up your door.
Okay. Well, I was thinking false pregnancy or something, you know.
No. Doesn't work that way.
No. Thanks, Barb. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, boy. Fran and Madison next. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I always enjoy listening. I get some great tips. But today I have a question.
Okay.
We have a shelter belt of mixed evergreens and a few oak hardwoods to the north of our house. And a pair of green herons has been nesting there the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, can I expect to see a whole bunch more move in? Do they create rookeries?
I think green herons are solitary nesters for the most part. I'd have to check my own bird books as a reference, but you hear about green herons here and there in isolated nests as opposed to many of the other species, the egrets and great blues and whatnot, that form a rookery. But I think green herons are solitary and behave more like a songbird in that regard. But don't hold me to that.
That's good news.
If you've got access to the internet, you can go to ebird.org and you can type in green heron and learn everything you ever wanted to know about them pretty easily if you don't have a bird book handy. But I'm pretty sure there are more. I don't think you can expect a shelter belt full of green herons.
That's good. We've had a great time watching them come and go, and they make the most absurd noises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're great. Thanks, Fran.
Thank you.
Doris in Two Harbors, Minnesota, up next here. Hold on a second. Let me just get something fixed here. Now I have it fixed. Are you there, Doris?
Oh, yes, here I am.
Thank you.
I have two questions quick. One, had a hummingbird feeder up last summer, and then a couple hummingbirds. I took it down because nothing was happening and went to clean it out, and I must have had hundreds of ants in it. I've never heard anybody talk about how you keep ants out of a hummingbird feeder.
Well, there are a variety of insects that cause problems in hummingbird feeders, whether it's ants or yellow jackets or a variety of other things. And usually there are bee guards and other guards that occur on the feeding ports of some designs of feeders. But I think in the case of ants that have to be coming down the support wire, that there are ways you can put a guard or some
Vaseline
or bird tanglefoot or some sticky product like that that will prevent the ants from passing down the wire.
Okay, sticky on the wire. Okay, good. Second question has to do with a situation with my dog when I was visiting relatives, and the dog is very old and was laying out in the grass and sleeping all day. And then all of a sudden we saw these large, I think they were turkey vultures, which they have quite a few around where they live, circling and circling and swooping down low over the garage roof and thinking, oh my God, are they after the dog? The dog is old and he kind of looks like a piece of dead meat when he's sleeping.
Well, that's probably what the vultures thought too.
You think? Is that what they were after?
Well, you know, the dead animal, what they think is a dead animal lying out on the ground.
That's dinner.
You know, that's dinner. But they were certainly no threat to the live dog.
No threat to the live dog. So if they had actually gotten to him and pecked at him,
I'm assuming he was alive enough to respond to a bird the size of a turkey vulture landing next to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he couldn't get away and run because he doesn't walk very well, but he would have howled like a banshee. I can tell you that.
As soon as he indicated life, the vultures would have lost interest.
Okay, great. I just wanted to know. It was really terrifying. I was reminded of the Hitchcock's The Birds, you know? I mean, they were swooping so low, I was afraid.
I think you and the dog are both okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Doris. All right, Karen in Mequon has something for us here. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Larry.
yes, I have a question. My sister lives in Mequon also. She has a pond in the backyard. And she had two muskrats in the pond, well, maybe a month or so ago we saw them. And we were a little concerned at the time, but just not sure. Anyways, and one of them was killed by something. And so it was just the one left. Well, now there's two again. Mm-hmm. And my question is, she has an Australian shepherd who loves to chase and catch animals. And I go over there to visit with my two labs, who are also pretty foolishly will go after wild animals. And I've had a number of, you know, very uncomfortable mm-hmm. situations where they've gotten at a live animal, I know, another wild animal. What, you know, do people have them live trapped and moved, or should we not be worried?
I guess I wouldn't be too worried. Any body of water in Wisconsin is likely to have a muskrat or two in it. They're pretty ubiquitous, just about everywhere, and they can take care of themselves. Anything attacking them in the water, they'll dive underwater and be gone. And in an open pond like that, if they don't have a den built that looks kind of like a miniature beaver lodge, it's likely they have a bank den, so they have a tunnel that goes back up into the bank of the pond with an entrance below the water level. So unless the rat happens to be out, you know, roaming around on the grass looking for something to eat and the dogs can get to it before it gets to the water, it shouldn't be a problem.
Okay.
And they're a big rodent, basically, with some pretty impressive incisor teeth. So, you know, unless the dog's quick, they're going to get bitten if they get a hold of one.
Right, that's what I obviously want to avoid.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, but, you know, all of us who are dog owners can't eliminate all the wildlife on the landscape just because our dogs are not trained to leave them alone.
I know. My one lab has gotten nipped a couple of times. You'd think he'd know, but
Well, labs take a little more training than some breeds.
Okay, but not to be concerned about them.
I don't think there's much you can do about it. Because okay. if you remove those two rats next spring, there'll be two more to take their place. More.
Well, and I guess that's the thing is they've lived there for, I would say, 15 plus years, and this is the first year they've had, or at least we've ever seen them, and we look out there a lot. So I don't know if we just never noticed them, but I find that unlikely.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Good luck. Thanks, Karen. And Mark in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm just calling about the person called about the green herons. We've had green herons on our property. We've got about 7 acres, half of it pine trees. And they do nest in groups if you have enough pine trees. That's
okay.
What they like. We've had 3 or 4 pairs at a time. They're easier to hear than to see. If you listen, the call that they have kind of sounds like 2 croquet balls hitting each other.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Not particularly melodious, but distinctive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Mark, and Karen and Gresham, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Could you repeat the guy's suggestion for keeping crows out of your garden? I didn't hear it. A man called in.
We talked about the notion of a dead crow, a crow decoy,
yes,
a variety of other things.
He called
in about stringing monofilament fishing line.
Monofilament.
Crisscrossed or in a grid or whatever you want to string above the garden. And, I mean, you have to get it up above the garden so that you can work under it. But the notion is that large birds that either hit the monofilament as they're coming in or detect it don't like it. It's a common tactic for protecting the runways and fish hatcheries.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yep. And also for protecting the tops of shore stations from seagulls.
Right.
Which is...
protects against a multitude of sins.
Scott, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit next month.
July already. We're talking July. Wow.
I know it. Scott Graven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. The summer already seems to be going fast, doesn't it? Oh, my goodness. Tomorrow, Andrew Blauner of New York City is the editor of Coach, a collection of sports essays by famous writers about the influence of their favorite coach. So we'll visit with Andy. And then at 11:45, Shirley Bauman of Madison talks about antiques and auctions. And she comes by every so often as well. And it's always fun to have her here. And it's great to have you listening in. And I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here this afternoon on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.